Welcome to the Special Needs Kids Are People Too podcast with Amy Bodkin, EDS. Amy is an autistic adult who also happens to be a school psychologist turned special needs consultant and public speaker. She's also a homeschooling mom to two autistic kiddos, a yoga instructor, a card-carrying Trekkie, and an all-around fun person. And last but not least, Amy is an advocate for seeing every child as a person, not a diagnosis. Because a special needs kid is just like any other child, just more so. Here's Amy Bodkin.
Hi, I'm Amy Bodkin, coming to you from the blanket fort in my office. And welcome to Special Needs Kids Are People Too. Today, I wanted to continue our conversation from last week about homeschooling to broaden that topic to embrace not just schooling online, but also electronics time in general, because I know that's a huge topic for parenting as well as homeschooling. And to do that, I would like to start by reading through an article with you guys. I'm going to pause throughout and give my own thoughts. But there is an article that was put out by the American Psychological Association that I feel like is one of the best articles I have read on kids and screen time in a long time. It was put out in April and May of 2020. So we're a few years out of date, and we've definitely increased our electronics time by a lot since that time. But I do still think that this is probably the best article I've ever read on the subject. What do we really know about kids and screens? Research by psychologists and others is giving us a better understanding of the risks and potential benefits of children's and teens' use of digital devices, by Stephanie Pappas. By the time research on screen time reaches the public, it's often framed in black and white terms, guidelines setting out strict time limits, or news reports with titles like, "Are screens bad for kids?" In reality, though, screen time research has been less than definitive, mainly owing to a lack of strong longitudinal studies to date. That's now beginning to change as psychologists and other child development experts take a deeper and increasingly nuanced look at children's and teens' use of tablets, phones, and other screens. Researchers are now paying close attention to the kinds of content kids are consuming via digital devices. They're looking at the environment that surrounds screen time, including parenting and socioeconomic status, and they're buckling down for the long haul, building new longitudinal studies that will help answer complex questions about kids, teens, and screens. In particular, they're studying both the potential benefits of screens, if they can be used as teaching tools, and the potential physical and mental health drawbacks. The picture that has emerged suggests that the youngest children don't learn well from screens. As kids get older, they can learn meaningful information from screens, but the ubiquity of digital devices also means that children can easily spend far too much time being sedentary. Nevertheless, total abstinence from recreational screen time may backfire for older kids and teens. And I do agree with this. When kids are young, they are working on language development skills, and if you handed a child, a small child, like a baby or a toddler, a book and said, "Here, read this and you will understand," well, most of them can't read. And even if they could read, it's not always a good means for them to get information from. And I would say that screens are very much the same way. We develop our language communication skills, generally speaking, face-to-face. They've actually done studies where they have seen if maybe watching television in the home might help kids who are born hearing to deaf parents to develop language, and it doesn't work. Language, generally speaking, does need to be learned at least with someone. And honestly, anyone who's tried to learn a second language watching TV probably knows this. It's very difficult to learn a language without some sense of community. And then, obviously, as children get older, yes, it can be more meaningful, but it can also mean that we're being still more. And, you know, our bodies do need to move to be able to be healthy and to grow right. So that's important. But avoiding screens entirely can sometimes lead kids to not knowing how to self-advocate, keep themselves safe, how to socially interact online, which is totally different than interacting with people. So that's a whole other thing, at least in person. Back to the article. Meanwhile, many questions remain about how much screen time is too much and about the effects of different types of activities that involve screens. As psychologists, it's really important for us to have scientific-based evidence behind what we're recommending. We're not there yet, says Jerry Lynn Hoag, PhD, a media psychologist at Fielding Graduate University. We have ideas, but the problem is that the technology is getting more and more sophisticated and more ubiquitous. The challenges of screen time. In all the popular media hubbub and scientific debate over screen time, it's easy to forget how quickly these issues have evolved. The first generation iPhone was introduced only 13 years ago, in 2007, the same year Netflix introduced streaming services. The iPad just saw its 10th birthday. Television and video games have been around for decades, of course, but never so portably and easily accessed. Amid this rapid change, professional organizations such as the World Health Organization and American Academy of Pediatrics have stepped in with recommendations. AAP calls for no screen time at all for children under 18 to 24 months, except for video chatting, and says kids aged 2 to 5 should get an hour or less of screen time per day. It has also developed the Family Media Use Plan for older kids, in which parents and children negotiate limits and boundaries around screen usage. In its guidelines on physical activity, sedentary behavior and sleep for young children, WHO similarly recommends no screens for kids under 2 and less than an hour a day for kids 2 to 5. However, some critics charge that much of the research backing up the guidelines is correlational, cross-sectional, or based upon self-report, though there are longitudinal studies in the mix too. And not all research effectively differentiates between different types of screen time. Many studies lump all screen time together into one category, though it seems unlikely that video chatting with grandma, for example, would have much in common with playing Grand Theft Auto V. Isolating the effects of screens from all the other experiences kids are exposed to is a challenge as well. It would be difficult indeed to run a long-term randomized study in which children were assigned to different amounts of screen time each day and then tracked over their lifespans to measure well-being outcomes. Imagine the look on a parent's face when told their child would be required to watch 6 hours of television every day, or that they could never watch a screen at all. What is clear is that many parents often don't enforce the screen time limits suggested by the guidelines. For example, a study led by economist Wei-Wei Chen, PhD, at Florida International University, found that as of 2014, children aged 2 and under in the United States averaged 3 hours 3 minutes a day of screen time, up from 1 hour 19 minutes a day in 1997. 3 to 5-year-olds got 2 hours 28 minutes a day of screen time on average during that time period. Qualitative studies suggest several reasons for the widespread screen use. One survey of 133 parents of preschool-age kids led by Rutgers University Professor of Nutritional Sciences Carol Bird Bredbinner, PhD, for example, found that many parents reported lacking affordable alternative entertainment for their kids. Others cited factors such as their own exhaustion, the need to get things done around the house, and bad weather for excess screen time. And I think this is an excellent point to be made, that different families are dealing with different circumstances. Sometimes families have a child who is physically disabled and is not able to get out and be physical. Sometimes families are forced to isolate because of a weak immune system. Sometimes families really need a babysitter and they can't afford it. And sometimes families live in an environment where it's not safe to send their kids out to play. So I think we really have to take into account individual situations when we're thinking about screen time. This is something that I gave a lot of consideration to myself because my kids were born about the time that screens were really beginning to kick off. And we had a lot of allergies and immune issues. I was homebound for at least a full year when they were small. And so there were a lot of things I had to say no to. And so I tried to say yes to whatever else that I could. And given that we weren't able to get out sometimes that meant saying yes to screen time. Now, in our case, the kids were older and had already developed language. And we're going to be talking about some of the other positive factors that we had going on that made that actually end up being a positive in their particular situation. But a lot of this stuff is very, very situationally based. And a lot of the research that we have, it's not as black and white as you think. And that's one of the things that bothers me when people start talking about screens. Because the truth of the matter is we don't know. And also that each person's environment is completely different. And so there isn't one answer for everyone. Continuing on, babies, toddlers, preschoolers, and screens. Research has, however, turned up evidence to support limiting screen time for babies and young children. One longitudinal study of 2,441 mothers and children led by University of Calgary psychologist Sherry Madigan, PhD, found that more time per week spent on screens at age 24 months and 36 months was linked with poorer performance on screening tests for behavioral, cognitive, and social development at 36 months. The opposite association, poorer development leading to more screen time, was not seen, suggesting that the linkage wasn't a matter of parents leaning on screen time to handle a challenging child. Instead, the excessive screen time seemed to precede the developmental difficulties. Despite experts' concerns, media for babies and toddlers has been on the market for years, often with promises of stimulation and education. The Baby Einstein videos are one prominent example. But the evidence is strong that screens aren't an effective teaching tool for the baby and toddler set, and they could displace the kinds of face-to-face interactions that actually help young kids develop. In a 2005 review led by developmental psychologist Daniel Anderson, PhD, now a professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, found that television viewing consistently failed to teach kids age 2 and younger as much as live interaction. This video deficit was seen in simple imitation tasks, in language learning, and in emotional learning. The basic pattern that has been found in dozens of studies is that children learn better from a person who is with them face to face than from a person on a screen, even if it's the exact same person doing the exact same thing, says Georgine Trosseth, PhD, a psychologist at Vanderbilt University. More recently, researchers like Trosseth are trying to understand why this screen learning gap occurs in toddlers. That toddlers struggle to learn from videos does not seem to be perceptual, Trosseth says, but conceptual. Until they are around age 3, kids seem to view video as irrelevant to real life. In numerous studies, toddlers shown video of an experimenter hiding a toy in the room next door are terrible at finding that toy in the real room immediately afterward. In one study co-authored by Trosseth, however, toddlers who watched a toy being hidden on a screen disguised to look like a window were much better at finding the toy than toddlers who saw the toy hidden on a regular screen. When they were told they were watching through a window, they were willing to take in the information, Trosseth says. The idea when they're watching on TV seems to be, "You're not going to fool me, I know that's not real." Those screen time recommendations for the youngest kids now make exceptions for video chatting. The evidence also suggests that toddlers find this medium confusing and that they struggle to make sense of video chat unless they have help from an adult who is physically present. In one study by Trosseth and her colleagues, for example, two-year-olds were assigned to either watch a pre-recorded video intended to teach them new words or to engage in a word-learning video chat session with an experimenter. In half the cases, the child's parent simply sat with the child. In the other half, the parent followed the experimenter's directions, modeling interactions with the video screen. A live video chat kept the kid's attention better than a pre-recorded video, but only kids whose parents participated alongside them were able to learn new words from the screen. 3 to 5-year-olds, on the other hand, are a bit more savvy. Since the early days of Sesame Street, research has found that this age group can learn from slow-paced, thoughtful-designed children's media. For example, in tests of pre-reading skills such as alphabet recognition and letter sounds, kids who were randomly assigned to watch a 20-episode run of the literacy show Super Why outperformed kids who were assigned to watch an educational science series. According to a study of 171 preschoolers conducted by Deborah Nichols, PhD, the director of the Children's Media Lab at Purdue University. Children from low socioeconomic backgrounds generally saw greater gains than children in the wealthiest families, possibly because the more privileged children were already exposed to more literacy enrichment than the less advantaged group. Television's educational potential isn't limited to academic skills. A study of the PBS show Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, led by Texas Tech University media researcher Eric Rasmussen, PhD, found that children who were randomly assigned to watch the program showed greater emotion recognition, empathy, and self-efficacy. If those children also came from homes where parents consistently talked to their children about their TV viewing. As with toddlers, preschoolers seem to benefit from adults co-viewing their media. Co-viewing may seem a steep price to pay for parents who are desperate to use their child's screen time to make dinner or pack tomorrow's lunch, but it doesn't have to be a full-time job, Hoag says. Rather, she recommends parents should aim to scaffold their child's screen time, first watching a few episodes with them and talking about the content, then stepping back and checking in as the child becomes familiar with how media works. This is definitely something that I did with our kids when they were small. I would sit and watch cartoons with them, or sometimes, well, mostly I would sit and watch cartoons with them so that they wouldn't get into trouble if I went in the other room. But sometimes I would turn the TV on in our great room and I could do dishes and watch them and watch the show and talk with them about it. And I do think that talking with the shows about them, pointing to things on the screen, that was very helpful in helping my kids develop some language. Generally speaking, television isn't known to help kids develop language. But like they said, if this is something that we are watching together, the benefit of a screen is that you don't have the sensory overload that you do outside when a butterfly gets in your face. So seeing a butterfly on the screen and talking about it and pointing to it on the screen can be less overwhelming to them. So I have definitely seen that. I do think that there's definitely an age where it's not as beneficial. It can be beneficial for distracting a child who will not sleep and you really, really have to go to the bathroom or something. I definitely had a child who refused to sleep. A lot of parents who have an autistic child do find that to be the case when they're small. It's extremely difficult to get them to take naps sometimes. And so in that case, sometimes I did find a video helpful, but we didn't do a lot of it when they were really small. It was more when we reached that preschool age and we were working on some of those language and academic skills that we were still having a hard time with. And I watched it with them because watching things with your kids makes a big difference. Continuing on, growing up digital. As children mature, they're exposed to more screens with more diverse content via television, video games, and social media. A report released in October 2019 by the nonprofit organization Common Sense Media found that 8 to 12-year-olds in the United States now use screens for entertainment for an average of 4 hours 44 minutes a day, and 13 to 18-year-olds are on screens for an average of 7 hours 22 minutes each day. These numbers don't count time using screens for schoolwork or homework. Common Sense Media's data also reveal a substantial disparity in media use based on socioeconomic status, with 8 to 12-year-olds from high-income families using 1 hour 50 minutes less of media each day than kids of the same age from low-income families. Teens show a similar gap. Previous research has suggested that increased screen time in poorer families may be an attempt by parents to protect their children. Studies in multiple countries have found that parent anxiety about neighborhood safety and actual neighborhood safety are linked to more screen time and less physical activity. For example, health researchers Valerie Carson, PhD of the University of Alberta, and Ian Jensen, PhD of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, found that kids who live in neighborhoods with the highest social and physical disorder, such as crime, graffiti, and gang activity, had a 40 to 60% higher likelihood of high screen use. Higher income families may also have more alternatives to screen time available in the form of extracurricular activities and safe recreation areas. So it may actually end up being that trying to avoid screen time is actually in some ways a privilege. So that's something to think about. As with young children, there are reasons for concern over large amounts of screen time in tweens and teens. Correlational studies have shown that 8 to 11-year-olds who exceed screen time recommendations scored lower on cognitive assessments, with compliance with recommendations explaining about a fifth of the overall variance in cognitive scores. A combination of screen time and too little sleep has also been associated with heightened impulsivity in the same age group. These studies weren't designed to show causal relationships, though, says Gary Goldfield, PhD, a psychologist of the University of Ottawa, who co-authored both studies. It could be that increased impulsivity or struggles with cognition drive the excess screen time. Nevertheless, in numerous studies, Goldfield and his team have consistently found the best mental health and cognitive outcomes in teens who do 1 hour of physical activity each day, sleep 8 to 10 hours a day, and use screens recreationally less than 2 hours a day. Researchers have also found links between screen time and various health outcomes in teens, though again, establishing definitive causal relationships is difficult. The firmest associations are between screen time and obesity and screen time and depressive symptoms, according to a systemic review published by the University of College London psychologist Neza Stiglic, PhD, and Russell Viner, PhD, a professor of adolescent health at UCL. Most research on obesity focused on television viewing and found that more time spent watching TV was associated with a higher body mass index or body fat composition. Multiple studies also found that screen use of more than 2 hours a day was correlated with depressive symptoms. The reviewers found moderate evidence linking screen time to poor quality of life, higher caloric intake, and less healthy diets. Evidence linking screen time to other problems such as behavior issues, anxiety, and low feelings of well-being and self-esteem was weak, with studies on these outcomes returning mixed results. And I think this is interesting because one thing that it's not talking about in this study is what types of screen time are we consuming? Are we talking about passively watching a television show? Are we talking about watching a documentary? Are we talking about video chatting with family and friends? Are we talking about playing a video game cooperatively with friends who don't live in your area? There are so many different kinds of screen time. And until we can have more studies that better define these things and also can prove causal relationships, we really can't say for sure. The one thing I will say is that when you're thinking about screen time, I think the most important thing to consider is, are we being a good consumer? And what does being a good consumer look like for us? You know, what kind of balance do you need in your life given your circumstances? What's going to help you be at your best? Continuing on, a study led by psychologists Amy Orban, PhD of the University of Cambridge, and Andrew Przybylski, PhD of the University of Oxford, found that screen time, as measured by time use diaries as opposed to retrospective self-reports, which many studies use, in large did not have noticeable effects on teen psychological well-being, according to national representative data sets in the United States, United Kingdom, and Ireland. So basically what that's talking about is that a lot of these studies are based on self-report and not actual diary inputs. And so some of the results may be biased based on what the participants think is going to be the outcome of the study, or what participants maybe think they've been using, even though that's not what they've been doing. But other research points to complicated relationships between screen time and well-being. For example, a study led by physician Pierre-André Michaud, MD, of the Institute of Social and Preventative Medicine in Lausanne, Switzerland, found a U-shaped relationship between internet use and adolescent mental and physical health, such that moderate users were the best off. A lot depends on how kids are using media, how much their parents are monitoring their use, how much time they're spending, and what exactly they're watching and using, says Victor Strasburger, MD, a pediatrician and professor emeritus at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. Future research and recommendations. Fortunately, a new longitudinal data set may help illuminate some of the outstanding questions about adolescence and screen time. In 2015, the National Institutes of Health began funding the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, the largest ever longitudinal study on teen brain and behavioral development in the United States. More than 10,000 9 to 10-year-olds have been recruited and are being followed to young adulthood. Screen time data are among the information being collected, and researchers are already using the first wave. Goldfield's cognitive and impulsivity studies drew from ABCD data. We're pretty excited about this database, he says. In the meantime, some experts recommend a mindful approach to media. Simply banning screens may backfire, says John Lasser, PhD, a psychologist at Texas State University and co-author with Mike Brooks, PhD, of the 2018 book Tech Generation, Raising Balanced Kids in a Hyper-Connected World. It's important for kids to develop the capacity to self-regulate, Lasser says, and parents who try to micromanage screen time may inadvertently interfere with that self-regulatory development. Lasser and Brooks include a tool in their book called the Family Assessment of Screen Time, or FAST, which family members can use to gauge their feelings about screen time, their own and each other's. The tool is similar to the AAP's Family Media Use Plan, in which parents and children 5 years and older negotiate limits and boundaries around screen usage. Finally, parents should keep co-viewing media with their kids. Keeping an open line of communication around media helps protect kids when they inevitably run into content they aren't ready to see, Strasburger says. A healthy, non-rancorous relationship around media also makes it easier to enforce boundaries when required. The number one recommendation that we give to parents is to spend time engaging with their kids, Lasser says. It's simple. It's good parenting, and it promotes a healthy relationship. So that was that article. I really love that article because I think it presents what we actually do know from research about the effects of technology on kids. There is some data out there, I know, that states that blue light can lower melatonin levels, especially when viewed close to bedtime. And there's a lot of other data out there that's trying to come out. What we do know is that it very much depends on the situation and that there are skills to be learned, but there are also potential damage to be done if we're not careful. So I completely agree with all of the professors in that article. I think that it's very important to try to keep some balance. So we don't want to completely eliminate screens entirely because the kids are growing up in a world with electronics and they do need to know how to keep themselves safe. And you learn how to keep yourself safe by having experience with the technology and the social skills required to navigate that technology. But I also think that it is important to make sure that we have balance in our lives. And sometimes that's going to mean that we spend a lot more time saying no to certain things. And so we say yes to other things. Like I was saying earlier about how we have done things in our family. We ended up saying yes to more electronics when the kids were younger because we had to say no to a lot of other things that were beyond our control. So I think the biggest takeaway is the point of electronics usage with kids is to teach them how to be good consumers. What does it mean to be a good consumer? What does that look like? And having those conversations with your kids, because lots of people will give you different answers as to what it means to be a good consumer. Sometimes raising a child with additional needs can be rather lonely. We can feel like we're the only one who is experiencing life the way that we are and feel lost that we don't know what to do next. My membership group provides families with the opportunity to build relationships with other families just like them so that they don't feel alone, so that their kids are able to make friends with other kids who get them. This is something that I help families navigate by walking through this process with them every week. It's like having a concierge school psychologist in your back pocket. But it's not just about the ongoing support, the free yearly testing, the weekly online meetings for kids and for parents. It's about leaving a legacy for your kids and your grandchildren. Check it out at amybodkin.com/product/special-needs-membership. Now, I have one more thing I want to share with you today. This is a Facebook post that I came across years ago. I can't remember who wrote it, but it was written by someone who was a user experience designer in video games. And she wrote about how to guide children in learning how to regulate with regards to video games. And I felt like this is the most common sense advice I've ever gotten on video games. And so I want to share it with y'all. What works in your family is going to be different from mine because you have a different set of experiences. You probably aren't, well, some people won't be growing up with tons of chronic health conditions that leave them homebound for a year or more at a time. Different people have different things going on. And you're going to have to make your own decisions based on your circumstances and what works best in your home. Here's the post. Because the local parenting group is discussing Fortnite addiction, there's some misleading rhetoric. I felt compelled to throw my two cents into the mix. I see people describing behavior about video games that I had over books and my youngest brother had over TV. And let me pause here and just say that is true. When children's literature first came out in the early 1900s, people were very concerned that it would rot their brains. And when TV first came out, they were very concerned it would rot their brains. So whatever the new tech is, it seems to be an issue until we get used to it. The media itself largely isn't the only issue. Big asterisks there that I will touch on. But teaching kids how to pull back from a pleasurable and dopamine-giving feedback loop to redirect to a less pleasant but necessary task is a life skill that takes time, and each generation has new tech or media that seems alien or inexplicable to the previous generation. So that when they see their kids, who are still developing willpower and restraint and still pretty bad at gauging balance, going through a fairly natural cycle of, I super enjoy this thing and would rather keep on doing it, to doing homework, chores, eating dinner, folks freak out. I think addiction is a word to be deployed with caution in this respect. By treating a child like an addict and treating their interests with hostility, you may end up undermining several useful connections and bonds. Video games encourage problem solving, spatial thinking, systems analysis, teamwork, creation of narratives, and many other useful mental abilities. In moderation, they can be used to bond with your kids and educate them. Yes, even games like Fortnite. I have great memories of spending time on my dad's lap watching him play Rogue, and many fun moments with my siblings as we all played Gauntlet or Mario Kart. My entire family, including my parents and some of my nieces and nephews, played World of Warcraft together. But the main thing is that kids are not so great at regulating feedback loops. Actually, most humans aren't either. An ongoing life lesson, it seems. Things you can do to help, and this is what I found particularly helpful. Acknowledge that they like to play and that it is fun for them. A lot of folks tend to try to be all, I don't even see why you like this thing that bugs me. And I think that sets up a dynamic that will reinforce me versus the game. Next, give each child an appropriate amount of time for free play. 1 hour seems like a decent base. After that, the child has to earn extra time, usually by doing X amount of other things. Explain that they can bank up to X, maybe 3 hours, to use it once. But also remind them that if they have a longer play session, you want them to take a 5-minute break once an hour. This is a good lifelong habit to have. Next, when earning extra time, make a similarly pleasurable but differently beneficial activity particularly attractive. If you notice they've gotten little outdoor time or you want to see them reading, offer a sale on their way to earn extra game minutes. Also, consider using a different style of game like Pokemon Go to get them out of the house. Consider going with them and using the time to bond over other types of conversation. Next, when starting the game time, try to set an early warning system. One of the main reasons people get upset being pulled out of a positive feedback loop is that they might be about to achieve something or they might be mid-battle. By setting a timer for the last 10 minutes, you can remind them that it's time to start winding things down. Finish the current quest or task and take care of any in-game logistics. If you got yanked out of a movie 10 minutes before the end, in the middle of a big climactic scene, you'd be cranky too. So helping them be aware that time is up will help you help them. Next, if you can, play with your kids a few times and get them to explain things to you. Have them try to explain what they like without belittling them. See if you can turn their explanation into something useful. Examples: talking about teamwork or the importance of clear communication or how yelling at teammates doesn't make people play better. I'm going to add in that screen time can be a great way of developing some social skills that we can then take out and use in the real world. All right, next on her list. Keep them rotating between activities, but see if you can create a natural rhythm that slowly changes the nature of their energy. Maybe they build up a lot of excitement and adrenaline playing Fortnite. Well, follow up their play session by asking if they want to go throw a frisbee in the park or go walk to the store for a treat. Then, after burning off energy, they might be ready to wind down to a more sedentary activity like reading comics on the couch together. and then homework, and then, as a reward, a half hour a fortnight. Each activity tends to have a resultant energy alignment that you can use to create positive, more balanced cycles. Next, getting your kid used to timing big tasks by breaking them down into smaller tasks will help with regulating game time. How? Well, by teaching kids that you do X for Y amount, and then you take a break or switch. The Pomodoro method for homework or cleaning is generally about spending 20 to 45 minutes focused on a task before taking a proportional break. It helps people be aware that they don't have to do something hard without respite or regrouping. An excellent life skill, by the way, one that I think many moms have trouble with. And conversely, training yourself to engage with a timer can help regulate when you need to balance something pleasant with something necessary, but perhaps not as fun. Now, for some of the caveats and that big asterisk, there are definitely games designed to take advantage of short-term dopamine bursts and the positive feedback loop. Casino games, for example, are often predicated on a low-energy, repetitive task that gives you almost immediate feedback. Adults who have learned how to regulate may find free-to-play games of this variety relaxing, but as we have noted, kids and some adults aren't so good at regulating that feedback loop. So this is where spending time with your kids playing the game comes in. Finding out if tasks are too simple for their level, and if there's a predatory element of monetization built in. Microtransactions, in-game purchases, aren't always a danger sign, because the reality of modern game development and the expectation of cheap or free games created this dynamic, but you should definitely eyeball them critically. If they are required for a game to advance, if most of the game is based on luck and not skill, and if rewards are randomized but not attached to demonstrating a skill or solving a puzzle, then consider steering your child to a different game. But do ask your kid to see what they might be getting out of it. They might not be fully cognizant of the benefits, but ask them what the goals are, what changes when they reach a goal, how can they reach the goal, are there alternate choices to make, etc. Sample combos. So you need to grab the flag and return it to your base. That sounds tricky. How do you plan on getting past these guards? What happens if you get it to this teammate? Why do you like playing this character? What skills do they have? Yeah, it's neat that the Romans start with this unit. That will really help when you try to establish a city. Anyway, best of luck. P.S. I'm a user experience designer in video games, for full disclosure. I've also been playing games for 40 years. Games tend to be like many other things in life. You can be excited and focused on them in a healthy way or unhealthy ways, but learning to self-regulate is a skill that will come in handy your whole life long. And I completely agree with that. I think I wanted to read a lot to you guys today because I feel like this is an area where you see a lot of books out there saying, oh, the research says this, the research says that. Well, the research isn't that clear yet, because it has electronics, especially iPhones, iPads, and all these other devices haven't been around that long. I mean, my kids were born about the time most of these things came around. And it usually takes a good 30 years before we start to see a change in the trend of the research. So we really don't know the answers right now. So when you see books and such talking about, oh, screens are evil and this is why, there's probably not a lot of research out there yet to definitively say that, yes, screens caused this. There may be corollary studies done. That's where, okay, these two things, we often see them happening together. But two things can happen together for very different reasons. One might not cause the other. So I think that those are some very important things to recognize, because you see a lot of talk about screens and parenting circles, and people like to pick a camp. I'm either the no screen camp or I'm the all screen camp. And really the answer is somewhere in the middle. There are a lot of benefits to screens. I often do recommend video games for kids who have spatial processing challenges, because there isn't anything that's quite like driving, like playing Gran Turismo on a video game, because even if you're on a garden tractor, you can still crane your head around, you don't have any problem with visibility. But when you're in a car, you have all sorts of blind spots and you're driving basically through a screen. So for some of those kids, they really need that practice at an earlier age with that type of spatial processing environment. Videos and YouTube videos can be really helpful at teaching kids skills in games that they can then use to their advantage when trying to make friends with other kids. My kids had a really hard time joining in conversations with other kids at the parks when they were small. So they started watching a lot of YouTube videos about Minecraft, thanks to Stampy Cat and Dan TDM, both British YouTubers, and they also started speaking with a British accent for a little while, which was hilarious. But they learned a lot about Minecraft, and it made them more interesting to their peers. Their peers were more interested in having conversations with them, and it gave them a way to join the conversation. So there are a lot of advantages to screens. There's also the advantage of learning to regulate how you use screens and learning to be a good consumer, how to keep yourself safe online. Those aren't things that we magically learn how to do overnight. So giving kids the opportunity to slowly develop those skills is very important. And it's also very important not to denigrate what they love, because you do not want to block yourself out of the conversation. Because those conversations you have with your kids is what helps you teach them to be a better consumer, how to self-regulate, and also how to keep themselves safe online. So online's probably not going anywhere anytime soon, and it's definitely a big part of their world that they're going to need to learn how to navigate at some point. How you do that in your family is totally up to you. Each family has a different set of circumstances. I think the most important thing is not to judge other families for their choices, because you haven't walked a mile in their shoes. And sometimes people have really big reasons that they use more screen time than others. Like in our situation, when we were going through severe health problems and we weren't able to get out of the house a lot. And I had to tell them no on so many other things, what foods we could eat, where we could go. I wanted to give them some yeses. And it ended up being a great opportunity. We learned how to play Minecraft together as a family. We still play together as a family quite often and enjoy it. It also gave them the opportunity to learn some social skills, to start learning how to keep themselves safe online. And they were playing together, side by side, helping each other. And I was coming in and out, monitoring what they were doing and giving them the tools and the training wheels to do that safely. It's like anything in parenting. It really is all about the relationship. It's not what you do. It's the relationship you have with your kids. If you prioritize the relationship every single time, I don't think you can go wrong. Thanks for joining me for a very technical and long conversation about electronics. I hope that it helps give you some guidance in thinking about how you might help your children become good consumers online. Thanks for joining me.
We hope you had fun listening to today's episode and gained some new insights into the wonderful variety of people in our world. You can find out more about Amy's advocacy work at amybodkin.com. And remember, special needs kids are people too.